And here we are. Welcome to Cinema Squabble, episode number 53. Adam Gerke, Sarah Michelle Fetters. And Sarah, would you believe this? We got to class this up a little bit.
I know, right?
We are joined by Radio Greatness. He comes to us from Northwest Public Radio, also King FM. You've heard him before. I almost feel like Steve Reeder. Ladies and gentlemen, I feel like I should be wearing, a smoking vest and a pipe or something like that, because you come to us as another mind of cinema, and you also taught at Seattle U a film studies course as well there. So
on occasion, yes, some of my specialties, French film between the wars and this and that. But yes, thank you for the homage at the outset today.
So there you go. I feel distinguished at this point.
You want an homage? When I first came to Seattle.
Yeah.
So when I was a student at the University of Washington.
Sure.
My first discovery was King FM and his cinema broadcast every week.
No kidding.
And I would listen to that religiously. And my roommate at the time, Phil, you've met him.
Yeah,
he would get so annoyed at me because I'd be playing Steve Reeder on King FM, listening to movie soundtracks and talking about how great they are and what else they relate to and how something by John Williams compares to something by Brahms or, whatever.
Exactly. Cinema Showcase, we called it.
Yeah. It was amazing. And Steve was one of my idols and one of the people that got me interested in doing what I do now.
Fantastic. Well, there you go. So, Steve, again, welcome to being with us here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure. I'm looking forward to it.
So let's just dig right into this, shall we? We've got a whole host of films to chew the fat on, so to speak. And the first being T2. This is Trainspotting.
Wait, there's no Terminator?
There's no. Unfortunately, there's no Arnold this go around. Although we do have Scottish accents aplenty. And it does take a little dialing in of your ear. So what specifically is going on here? This is director Danny Boyle returning back to the train spotting of the mid-90s. So we've got Ewan McGregor, Ewan Bremner, Johnny Lee Miller, and who plays Bigby?
Robert Carlyle.
All the characters
that
folks were familiar with in the mid-90s in train spotting. So you've got Renton, you've got Simon, you've got Sick Boy.
And Bigby,
Franco, and they've returned. Yep. At this point, we find Renton returning back to Edinburgh, back home after 20 years. And this is a film that Danny Boyle didn't want to shoot until now, because it looks like the actual actors have some weather to them. Mm-hmm. And so we now actually have cause for returning to this story. We pick up love, friendship, hatred, betrayal, drugs, oh yes, drugs. And that is kind of the core of Trainspotting to what good can come of this. That is sort of the gist of this.
I think that's part of the core of it, but also it's just who these men were in 1996.
Yes.
What made them who they were in their youth, in their early 20s or late 20s in the case of Frank Begbie, the choices they had made, and then how they've weathered those choices over 20 years.
Yeah.
And I think one of the great things about this sequel is that it doesn't actually let any of those characters off the hook. It doesn't sugarcoat things. I mean, at the end of Trainspotting, there is that sort of little slight glimmer of hope, especially for Renton and Spud. But the nature of addiction, the nature of just living in that environment, that being who they were, it would almost be surprising if they were all if they suddenly came out unscathed. And so to see Spud still battling with those demons, being still a heroin addict.
20 years later,
the fact that he's still alive.
I mean, one friend that never left him.
Yeah, I mean, that it's heartbreaking, and yet it's also fitting. And I did love that about the film, and that it doesn't let these men off the hook.
Yeah, I think there's a great centerpiece to the whole film where we see Renton in a restaurant basically describing the middle age experience, which is to say so much as you're questioning your whole existence. And we watch him kind of deconstruct his whole experience as an adult, going from child to an adult, and what that has meant, and really facing up to a lot of his failures. And I found this in many regards, because now that I'm becoming a middle-aged man, I can sit here and go, yeah, I get this. Man, what I specifically love about this film is that, now, I have never been a heavy drug user or anything of the sort, but back in the mid-90s when this film came out, it spoke to Gen X. Mm-hmm. It spoke to a generation, people who were disenfranchised youth, people who wanted to, you know, stick their finger at, you know, chant their fist in the sky and yell at the man. And it's that same crowd now. So very relevant to the youth that I had now, to the adulthood that I had. I found this to be poetic in many regards, and Danny Boyle leaves no stone unturned as far as his poetic nature or his visuals that he brings to it.
Well, you do have to throw in screenwriter John Hodge, who's also returning here. Yeah. I mean, I think they found a really nice way to bring this story back.
Yeah.
Is it necessary? I'm not sure it actually is. Mm. I mean, do we really need to return to this world? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
But I think they did it in a believable, authentic, honest way that is captivating throughout. Yeah. At least it was for me.
In a resonant way. And I think that's where John Hodge, who won an Oscar nomination 20 years ago for writing this screenplay, and the author Irvine Welsh, the author of the great modern Scottish novel, who gets cameo here in one scene as an upscale fence. I think this is why we need it again. Precisely because of the scene you described, Adam. Mm-hmm. It's Renton talking about social dysfunction. Mm-hmm. Social dystopia, failed relationships. And of course, one other point that I would make, it's a very Scottish film, and as someone who has 50% Scottish blood flowing through his veins, I would like to point out it's very Scottish in very specific ways. For example, both stories are about class struggle class conflict. They're about social dysfunction. They're about people who are trapped. They're about very complex failed relationships, and even the core group of four men here 20 years later have these extremely complex male bonding experiences and relationships. They hate each other, but they love each other, and they can't get away from each other because that is the only universe in which they feel comfortable or viable or kind of able to control their lives in any particular way. So it's a beautiful, modern, urban, Scottish, British story in that regard.
Yeah, yeah.
And that one scene, I mean, it is, again, it's a reworking of the choose life mantra from the original film. And it the way that McGregor delivers it, the way that Hodge has written it, and the way that Boyle has directed that moment, especially because McGregor is telling it to someone, and I don't really want to talk too much about her because I think she's a great character, but he's telling it to someone who is in some ways the pseudo Renton from 20 years earlier, except without the addiction problems.
Yes.
Mm. So she's everything in many ways that Renton wanted to be when she was his age. Mm. But because of the heroin, essentially, he could never aspire to that.
But an interesting spin on this other person whom we can't mention specifically here. And that is that this person is an outsider.
Yes.
This person is not a native Scot. This person brings a 21st century perspective to that particular character and that particular relationship.
Yeah.
I mean, where I'm coming in on this, if it's not obvious at this point, it's a strong theater recommendation from me. Steve, how about you?
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And Sarah?
It's a theater. I mean, it's a good movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's... we're going to have to look back on it in a few years, obviously. I don't think it's the instant classic that Trainspotting was, but it's still damn good. And to try to compare it to a film that is a classic...
Yeah.
Don't do it. Just go see it because it's a great movie.
Yeah. I guess the one other point I would make on it is it does have enough nostalgia to it, but to me it walks the line between nostalgia and fresh material enough that I don't feel like it's just, oh, hey, remember this? Well, we're going to bring it back. And it's not just recursive and just kind of continuing on its old tropes, I guess.
The same kind of kinetic style, though. I mean, Danny Boyle clearly made it a point of bringing the same kind of energy and vigor to the story that he did 20 years ago. And we get just enough references to these characters of 20 years earlier, the 1990s, that we feel they are rooted in history and in their own experience.
I know we can't go too much into it. I know we need to move on. But don't you just love the way, though, that Anthony Dodd Mantle shot the film in a way that evokes what they did in 96, and yet also still feels visually mature in a way that equals the age of these characters now. I think that's kind of extraordinary. It's like paying homage to the original cinematographer and what he was able to accomplish, but at the same time still putting an indelible stamp that says, no, this is made now.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it delves into color correction. Mm-hmm. Also, by the way, if you haven't figured out the soundtrack to this, and pretty much to almost any Danny Boyle film, the soundtrack, in my opinion, this is going to be the next mix on your iPod. So just be prepared. It's ready for prime time on that regard. good. So, Personal Shopper is another film, came out last week here for us in Seattle. This is Kristen Stewart. Steve, tell us a little bit about Personal Shopper.
Well, it's an extraordinary film, and it has sharply divided critics and audiences ever since it first played Cannes. It was the first movie booed by critics at the Cannes Film Festival last year, and still won the Fipresky Prize for Best New Screenplay. Well, Kristen Stewart plays the title character. It is a French set story, for the most part. Yes. She plays the personal shopper to a celebrity whom, quite deliberately, we hardly ever get to know. She only appears in two scenes, I believe. Yeah. But this is a young woman, Kristen Stewart, the personal shopper, who may or may not have a connection to the other world, the next world, an outer world, a supernatural world. She may be a kind of medium, whether she fully realizes it or not, and it may involve her twin brother. You'll notice that I'm going to use lots of mays and mites here, because the writer-director, Olivier Assayas, who did Clouds of Sils Maria, also with Kristen Stewart, did a wonderful French film about a decade ago called Summer Hours, contributed to Carlos, the masterful international TV series. He loves enigma, and he loves measured pacing. And so we have all these moments when Kristen Stewart's character, as she goes about her daily business, all of the shopping and delivering and seemingly mundane interacting with various characters around Paris and, you know, sort of motor scootering around the capital, she may in fact be in touch with another world. She may be in touch and waiting for a sign, any kind of definitive sign from her late twin brother. And she may find it in various places, including the now all but deserted mansion out in the rural areas, the suburbs of Paris, where her late brother and her sister-in-law may have lived at one time, where he may have died. And there's much enigma, quite deliberately so, on the part of Assayas. And the question is, how much do you want to probe this young woman's character? How much are we let into the story? One of the main problems I have with the film is that every scene is paced just like every other scene.
Yeah.
It is extremely measured in that regard. And so I found it a little difficult to kind of get into the story or become emotionally, psychologically engaged with the lead character. But it's fascinating. And one final point for now before we dig into this more deeply.
Yeah.
I love Assayas' use of audio design. That is one of the hallmarks of his filmmaking. Very effective. Yeah. Very atmospheric, and without overdoing it. So it's a very atmospheric film, and I can readily understand why it divides critics. I found it partially satisfying for all of those reasons.
Yeah. Sarah?
I thought it was extraordinary. I don't think it's up to the same level of Clouds of Sils Maria. I don't think it's up to the same level of, say, Demon Lover or Carlos or Summer Hours. I do think it's very similar, and yet tonally completely different, yet still similar to the movie he made with Maggie Cheung back in the 90s, Irma Vep.
Oh, yes.
They would make a great double bill because they are both essentially about outsiders motor scootering around Paris, figuring out who they are and where they fit into this milieu. I think this is, what I will say is, I think this is Kristen Stewart's best performance ever. I think she is haunting in this movie. And the level of deconstruction that she engages in, watching her sort of take bits and pieces of herself and her own psyche apart slowly as the film progresses, especially as there's sequences in the film where we have a lot of back and forth via text messaging. Watching her deal with those sort of things, I think, is just marvelous. I get why everybody, I mean, even the people that didn't like the film all said she was wonderful in at Cannes, and I get that. I think this is some of her finest work, and I also get why Assayas just adores working with her.
See, and I'm on the other side of the fence on this one. I'm watching what she's doing, and I'm going, I'm not really impressed. You know, I think anybody can look at a phone and look surprised, or look at a phone and look concerned. I don't really see quite the effort that you're seeing in this, that I'm watching this performance and I'm kind of going, I am not connecting, like Steve, I'm not connecting with this character because of its metered pace. I'm also not caring. I lost interest in the film probably about, I'll say almost halfway through. And meanwhile, in some of these scenes where we're watching her scooter around, for some reason in the back of my head, and I realize it's not that kind of film, but halfway through the film, I'm saying, I'm waiting for some car to just creamer on her scooter for some reason. It's like, I know that's not where this is going, but I'm braced for that the whole time. So I took very different things from this that I saw a very different film personally than I think than what you were seeing. The other issue I had with this is that I think there are unnecessary transitions that happen. The final scene that we have, it happens in a location I don't even think is necessary.
I would completely disagree
with that. And I mean, she, you know, I would disagree. I would say she doesn't need to go there. It doesn't need to happen. You know, there's
If she does not end up at that place at the end of the film, then she cannot have the revelation that she ultimately has, which we cannot talk about. But that last scene, is one of the best scenes we're going to see in any movie this year, bar none, just for what is revealed and what you learn that this movie potentially has been about the entire time.
But see, I would almost disagree. I think you could achieve that same thing in the same area or same location. But I don't think, and that big reveal, it left at the screening that I was at, it left everybody in the theater going, what did I just see? So the very questions that Steve is coming here with, mays and mites and possiblys, everyone walked out of the theater going, what the hell was that? And if that's the point, I needed more.
No, well, I mean, and she can't have, I'm sorry, Steve, I don't mean to, she can't have that revelation back in Paris because she's too close to her brother. Mm-hmm. They're so intertwined that she can't escape him until she's actually outside of the city. I mean, and that has been one of the points of the entire film. And people keep sort of bringing that up to her very politely in that sort of French way. But, I mean, there's a lot. There are many moments in the movie where people are like, you know, Maureen, maybe you should like go take a vacation. Maybe you should get out of town. Hmm. And she can't know things about herself that intimately until she's away from her brother's death. And a lot of that has to do with how closely they were connected, not just by being twins, mm-hmm. but by also some other things that you learn throughout the film.
So much goes unspoken and I think deliberately unwritten by Assayas here. And I will say this much about the final scene. Mm-hmm. Because this is a French production, mm-hmm. a mostly English language French production, I'm inclined to believe that that final geographical setting, which I will not reveal for purposes of this particular podcast, I think it has particular significance to the French and to a French public. It's not just that Maureen needs to get out of Paris. Mm-hmm. She needs to go to a particular area mm-hmm. where the French have often found either repose or some kind of spiritual awakening or some kind of personal awakening. And I think that is probably one of the reasons why this seemingly unusual mm-hmm. choice occurred to Assayas. Mm-hmm. I think we should also mention, by the way, that there is a murder mystery mm-hmm. enveloped in this story.
Yes.
And there is an extraordinary sequence, not at the very end, but near the end, that takes place in a hotel suite.
Yes.
And Assayas mm-hmm. deliberately wants us to imagine, is this real or is this literal? And at the screening I attended, many, many people were walking out puzzling over that particular sequence going, I picked up on all the clues. I picked up on all the visuals.
Right.
I got it. There was no dramatic music to cue me into what was going on or apparently going on, but I'm still not quite certain what happened there.
Yeah.
And I will say, whether you felt like she gave a great performance or not, mm-hmm. Stewart did work for this performance because she could not go to work for months after she finished this movie. Hmm. She was so psychologically and physically drained that she could not do any other projects. And she purposely told Assayas that they needed to do this movie first before she went into the Woody Allen movie because she did not think she would be physically and mentally capable of working on that lighter film if she did, you know, if she did
interesting.
This one.
See, and
if they were the other way around.
I would have said that maybe about Clouds, but not about this. But that's just my take on it. So ultimately, where do the two of you come in on this? I'm in more of the rental category. I wouldn't go seek this one out. If you're a fan of Assayas, okay, maybe go see, but really to me, this is more of a rental. Steve, Sarah, how about you two?
Well, I think we know where Sarah stands. I would give it a guarded see it in the theater for all kinds of reasons. The sound design, you want to be caught up in the story, in the moment, in the visuals, in the whole atmosphere and various settings of the piece. And I think it also works well because it is kind of, in its own way, an intense psychological story that's not going to work as well on the small screen or a smaller screen for me. I do like the idea. And if you love art film and something that's really probing and challenging, and by the way, this is her movie. She carries this film. She is the central character. I would give it a guarded yes. See it in the theaters.
Okay.
I mean, not everybody is going to like this movie. I mean, flat out, this is the way it's going to work. I mean, I'm not going to try to convince you otherwise. But I do think you should see this movie in a theater. Mm-hmm. It is It is what cinema is supposed to be about. Hmm. It challenges you. It makes you think. It makes you ponder different things. And as you keep thinking about this film later on, days later, weeks later, months later, you're going to find that you're going to discover little hidden meanings and little hidden passages throughout that, whether you like it or not, they're going to stick with you.
Okay. Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that. Sarah, you also had a chance to catch up with a little film by the name of Devil's Candy. You're the only one that had a chance to catch up with this, too, by the way. So fill us in a little bit on what's going
quick.
On with this.
I'll go a little quick. It's platforming in theaters around the country. It's not going to ever open wide, but it is available on VOD right now and also on Amazon and on demand and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It is called The Devil's Candy. It's from filmmaker Sean Byrne. And it's his sophomore film, and it actually premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in 2015.
Mm. So this has been kicking around for a while.
It is. The reason for that...
Is this the same version that was at 2015?
Yes.
Has he made any tweaks to it since then?
Okay. No. This is released by IFC Midnight. Now, Sean Byrne's first film was 2009's The Loved Ones, which was basically a John Hughes prom movie meets Carrie.
Yeah.
And it was phenomenal. This movie is a heavy metal version of The Exorcist.
Okay.
And it is flat out awesome. It's the best performance that Ethan Embry has ever given. And if you remember young little Ethan Embry from Can't Hardly Wait, he's sort of matured into a pretty good character actor. He gave a great performance in a movie a few years ago called Cheap Thrills. Mm-hmm. And he's been some other stuff where he's done a really nice job. But here he's a struggling sort of heavy metal artist who just by blind luck ends up discovering that there's this Texas house out in the middle of the country that is cheap. It's affordable. And because he's starting to take some jobs as a freelancer, he's painting a mural for a bank, and his wife has a really good job, they can actually afford it, and it would give them both a place to sort of relax and their teenage daughter, while she's not totally thrilled with the idea, she also is going to get a new guitar out of it, and she's going to get a place where she gets to rock out and do the things that she wants to do without any, issues. Turns out, though, that the house had some strange deaths there that the realtors thought were accidental that weren't accidental. A man named Ray, played by veteran character actor Pruitt Taylor Vince, he had a little bit more to do with this than anybody realized. And it turns out that he may be also a heavy metal enthusiast. There's a theme going on here. He may be communicating with the devil. And
as is very heavy metal. Okay, yes.
All and right. He's been feeding the devil the devil's candy.
Okay.
And I'm not going to reveal what the devil's candy actually is.
All right.
If you've read your Bible, you're going to be able to figure it out.
Yeah.
It's horrible, and yet it's awesome. The movie is psychologically dense.
Uh-huh.
It's scary as hell.
Yeah.
Ethan Embry is fantastic. Pruitt Taylor Vince hasn't gotten a role this good in a long time.
Yeah.
It is balls to the wall, full throttle, heavy metal, possession horror that goes right where it needs to go, and it is a hoot, and it's gory, and it's fun.
Where does the soundtrack fall in all this, or the scoring of this?
There's not a lot. The score is very heavy metal esque, and they do it without actually being, because they're not really ever able to throw any metallic or anything like that into the movie itself.
Yeah.
So the score has to bring you that.
It embodies all things metal without necessarily picking band XYZ. Sure.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And this movie, if you can find this movie, I can't really tell you to see it in the theater because it's not really playing in a lot of theaters, so I'm going to tell you to VOD it. I'm going to tell you to pay the $10 on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
If you like this sort of thing, watch it. It's maybe the best movie I've seen so far this year at this point.
Wow. High remarks then for Devil's Candy, The Devil's Candy. Okay. Steve, you also caught up with a film. You're the one that caught up with this one by yourself. Wilson. This is Woody Harrelson, correct?
This is Woody Harrelson. I have to tell you, this movie is not going to open wide either, but it's not nearly as intense.
Okay.
That's what Sarah's just described. This is not gory.
Uh-huh.
It's not particularly loud.
Sure.
But it's a movie that grows on you. I found it very slow. But slow. I'm a huge Woody Harrelson fan, and I admire the range of roles that he's always taken on to challenge himself over the course of his career. Craig Johnson directed this. Mm-hmm. It's only like his fourth or fifth feature film, but more importantly, it was written by Daniel Clowes based on his own graphic novel.
Hmm. And
it's about a middle-aged man, kind of neurotic, kind of estranged, lacking certain social skills, but never afraid to speak his mind and to sort of speak for the everyman. There's a quality of everyman about Woody Harrelson. He's a gentle character. He lives with his dog. Mm-hmm. His dog is his whole life when we meet him. Hmm. By the way, we never establish at any point in the story what he does for a living.
Hmm.
He doesn't exactly live in an expensive home in this small town, but we never establish what he does for a living, but he just goes about his daily business.
Yeah.
His father passes. His father has never really given him the overt love or statement of love that he would want from a father. And now he's feeling estranged. He's feeling cut adrift emotionally. And so he goes seeking out some kind of human connection, often in very witty and wise ways. There's a wonderful scene with Margot Martindale in a diner in which the two of them have met. And they have this sort of tentative conversation about their various failed relationships and all the rest. And Woody Harrelson's character, the title character Wilson, reveals that he was once married, and what a shame that his ex-wife, Poppy, played by Laura Dern, quite beautifully for the most part, decided to abort their child because he feels that led to the end of their marriage. Later, he discovers, well, wait a minute, not only is she still alive, by the way, much like Renton in T2 Trainspotting, he has this aversion to all social media. The cyber world. So when he finds out, oh my God, we can Google somebody. Oh, that's my ex-sister-in-law. That's my ex-wife. Where do they live? Let me track them down.
Right.
He tracks down his ex, learns that indeed she did give birth to the daughter, immediately gave her up for adoption, and now Woody Harrelson wants to reconstitute a family. Wilson would like a family in his middle age.
Huh.
And again, along the way, there are all these wonderful knowing scenes, and this is why the movie started to grow on me, because it became richer and richer. He would get onto a bus, for example, or a train, completely empty car, completely empty bus. Otherwise, he would sit down next to the one person who's there with the buds in the ears, demand their attention, and demand that they communicate with a real living human being.
Right, right.
And he would pretend to be, you know, like a Bible peddler, whatever it would take to annoy them enough to engage with him in some way. Anyway, there's this wonderful bonding that happens with him and Laura Dern. They have to, like, reclaim their past. It was a very physical relationship, it turns out, and not to his betterment. We also meet Isabella Amora, a wonderful young actress who plays Claire, their daughter. Of course, she's been raised by this loving couple whom she now considers her real parents, but Woody Harrelson is trying to form this whole new family unit without disturbing the other family unit, there are some wonderful set pieces. So it's slow, it's not real loud, but over the course of time, it's one of those movies that betrays this wonderful humanity.
Mm-hmm.
You can see this is how life is lived in 21st century America. This is how we try to define or redefine family or reform. Judy Greer plays an acquaintance of his dog sitter, and even after his dog has passed, that's not a huge plot point, not a spoiler, they then bond in certain respects. Lots of wonderful supporting work. Woody Harrelson carries the film, but not in a kind of epic, virtuosic way. Low-key, knowing way. My one quibble.
Yeah.
There are a couple of set piece scenes in which characters explode emotionally, one of them unfortunately involving Laura Dern, and I realized that would look far better on the page of a graphic novel than being spoken or declaimed by an actor in a motion picture, because it rang a little false for the moment.
Interesting.
Overall, a nice, quiet, very American, very contemporary kind of character study.
Sure, sure. So you're putting this into the theater category as well?
I would put it in the theater category, absolutely, yes.
Okay.
Well, everything is just doing so well.
And it's March.
And I'd like to kind of curious about this, because last we saw Woody Harrelson, to my recollection, was in Edge of 17, where he also plays a middle-aged character, a little quirky.
So good in that movie.
And I love that. I love that film. Do we see crossover here? Because did you catch up with Edge of 17?
I did indeed.
Okay.
Oh, yes, we're getting the thumbs up here from Sarah. Yes, I did see Edge of 17. There is a certain overlap in terms of his character and certain mannerisms and certain situations. Yes, absolutely. Sure. So there's a little bit of self-reference there.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. I'm always curious to see where actors, their real life and their various different characters, all have that Venn diagram where they overlap just a little bit, or if we get that cross-pollination going on there. Always kind of fun to watch for. You know, the last film too, Sarah.
For
this week at least, yeah. Strong point. Point well made, point well taken. Life.
Yeah, I mean,
so, ironic that that would be the last
one, right?
Yeah,
well, sure. I mean, to be honest, there are three big films opening this week, and mm-hmm. we had to make our choice between two of them. We could only see Life or Power Rangers.
Go Power Rangers
at the same time, and Steve and I chose Life.
Sure,
we chose Life.
Choose Life.
We chose Life.
Boy, which I thought was very wise of us, by the way.
We yeah. also could have technically chosen Chips, which. Did screen, I discovered, but you had to be, as a press person, you had to actually ask to yeah. attend, but which is not really a great sign.
And coming up here, just to preview in a moment, we'll be talking about the rating yeah. system here, but when I last checked on the controversial Rotten Tomatoes, Chips was at 33%. So there is that.
Yes.
Interesting.
Still there. 32%.
Okay. Now 32%. Okay.
I'm live fact checking you. You're like the president.
very, very big. Okay, so continue.
But Life is just a contemporary science fiction thriller. It's set on the International Space Station. A team of scientists led by our captain, who actually, I should say, she is from the CDC. Because the captain actually, there's a Russian captain who's technically in charge. But we have a CDC scientist who is responsible for the... experiments that are about to take place, and that's mm-hmm. and she's played by Rebecca Ferguson, if you remember mm-hmm. her from the last Mission Impossible film. Mm-hmm. Also part of the crew are Ryan Reynolds, Jake Gyllenhaal, Hiroyuki Sanada, a bunch of other people. I mean, it's a very multi-ethnic cast, mm-hmm. and they're up on the International Space Station because a probe from Mars is returning,
mm-hmm.
and it's the first one that's bringing back core samples mm-hmm. from the Red Planet. And they want to study those not on Earth. So they're going to study them on the space station.
In space.
And the reason they're going to study them up there is just on the off chance that there's
something there.
And yeah. and it turns out there is something there.
Huh.
They discover a life form.
Huh.
And they nurture it.
And it's a beautiful little starfish.
Yes. It's basically like a little, it's a little Cthulhu jellyfish.
Huh.
Well, I'm just going to throw weird references out here.
A Martian Cthulhu jellyfish.
Yes, and they and elementary school students back on the planet Earth name it Calvin,
uh-huh.
and they take care of it and they feed it what they think it needs.
Where does this become Splice?
It doesn't necessarily become Splice,
uh-huh.
but it does become alien.
Uh-huh.
Our little Martian is not. The polite little soul
uh-huh.
that you think it is. And what it turns out is that this little Martian, much like, say, the Thing,
mm-hmm.
cannot be allowed to get to Earth.
Uh-oh.
It cannot be allowed to survive. If it gets to Earth, Earth could become Mars, potentially.
Mm-hmm.
And so our team of scientists do everything they can, even if it means giving up their own lives, to stop this creature. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, one by one, they... fall by the wayside. You can pretty much, for the most part, follow the cast list. I'm not really yeah. going to give you any spoilers here. I mean, it's one of those. It's an Alien-esque movie.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at who is listed where in the cast, you're probably going to be able to figure out where they're going to go.
Right.
All building to, you know, that haunting gotcha ending.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really about it.
Reynolds and Jake Gyllenhaal, is this a funny film at all? Is there humor involved with this?
Yeah.
Occasionally there are sly, sardonic comments. Absolutely, yes, as this genre would demand. I wanted to point out this is Ryan Reynolds reuniting
yep.
with the director Dan Espinosa in this film, by the way. Yes, it's a classic claustrophobic horror film, but we should also point out that this life form, this single-cell life form, which they've brought from Mars, is extremely intelligent.
Yep.
So it's not just a monster horror film. It's about a very special kind of interstellar intelligence at play here as
uh-huh.
well. We've already had this discussion, Sarah and I, so allow me to repeat myself for
sure.
purposes of this podcast and this audience. The film does not interest me very much from the point of view of the story or its structure or the way it plays out. Because, uh-huh. again, like an Agatha Christie story, we know one by one, more or less, what's going to
yeah.
happen
yeah.
until the very ending. However, atmospherically, I would highly recommend this film. The cinematography
mm.
is extraordinary. The framing, the color palette, the poetic images. I mean, image after image are going to stay with me for a long time. Images of driplets of blood and water, for example. Images of the life form itself as it evolves, and it does evolve considerably over the course of the film. The director, oddly enough, despite his name, Dan Espinosa, is a Swedish native. And he's working here with a fellow Swede again, Jan Ekstrand, who's responsible for the music. And that's also an extraordinary part of this film. It's symphonic, and it's wonderfully atmospheric. It doesn't overpower the story or the moment to my mind and my ear, but it does accent it. And it gives you that sense that, as our commander from CDC keeps pointing out, the story is ultimately about quarantine. We want quarantine. We want isolation. And I think the music really underpins that aspect to the drama and the psychology of the story.
And I'm with you, and I like the score an awful lot. But do you feel sometimes that this movie is scored within an inch of its life, that it almost, it almost relies upon that score to make up for kind of the cliche, rudimentary nature of the screenplay?
Entirely possible, because I concede the story is not going to surprise anyone. In fact, I was not surprised by the ending. Again, you could sense that was coming. But as a study in atmosphere, literally, in atmosphere or the lack thereof, thought it worked. I thought Jake Gyllenhaal made the most of his character.
I do too.
I would say that much.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good group of six actors, essentially, on board this vessel, this International Space Station. But you go, I would say, for the atmosphere, and I would recommend this being seen in theaters if you're at all interested, but you go for the atmosphere and the psychology, not for the narrative itself.
Okay, so two quick questions about this, because our producer Sprints has given us the stink eye on this one real quick. I want to ask, you've painted the cinematography, it sounds Roger Deakin-esque, in sort of you've kind of given me the description of these, you know, blood spatters and this mist and fog or mystery or something.
Slow motion and all that, lack of gravity.
But it isn't obviously Deakin's, it's somebody else. Mm-hmm. Of which I'm not looking at a list of things, but also musically,
the Seamus McGarvey.
Okay.
Or Seamus McGarvey.
Seamus.
But also musically, looking at the score, do you recognize the instrumentation going on here? I mean, like, for instance, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. We are looking at purely strings. This is what they could afford, and this is what they could create, and that's what we're left with. What do you see going on here, score-wise, with that?
Strings and low winds.
Okay.
Low winds.
So it's not full orchestra, but it's...
It's definitely full orchestra.
Oh, it is.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, there's a clear emphasis. Forget about flutes, for example, or oboes. You're listening to horns. You're listening to trombones.
Oh, okay.
You're listening to bass clarinets. You're listening to low, rich, dramatic sounds. But again, I know what Sarah's saying. I would disagree slightly on the music. It's not that it overpowers. Mm-hmm. What it does not do, and this pleases me, it does not telegraph every emotional or narrative moment for me. It accents the setting. Okay. Without overpowering it.
Okay. So between the two of you, where do you come in on this? Sarah, where are you sitting on it?
The ending annoyed me. Not because I didn't expect the ending, or not because I didn't really dislike the ending, but the way that Espinosa draws the last 10 minutes out is, John Carpenter would have just got right to the point and said, okay, this is where we're at. And it would have worked a lot better. This is so melodramatic, and the final reveal is just annoying. The movie's cheesy as heck, but it's got a lot of great moments. And the opening tracking shot that's not a tracking shot is extraordinary.
So it's a rental.
I'm going to go a high rental, actually. Okay. Yeah, a rental. It's a rental.
Okay. And Steve?
And I'm proud of Sarah for not mentioning Venom once in the course of this review.
I was about to.
All right.
I would say see it in the theater only if you want to go for literally a movie set in outer space.
Okay.
Again, it is cheesy in many ways, the story. But the setting and the way it plays out, that's good for the big screen.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, and in better news, my bracket still lives. Gonzaga won.
Gonzaga just won. All right. By the way, we're recording this Thursday evening at 7:16. Sarah just gave the old high five and thumbs up. So, okay, go Zags. Meanwhile, one of the things we were touching on earlier, we were talking a little bit about the rating systems, and we were talking a little bit about...
Not like R, PG-13. We're talking about critic rating systems.
Yeah, the Netflix rating system, the Rotten Tomatoes rating system, the Metacritic, the IMDb. Everyone's got their own 5-star, 50-star, billion star, even as it was, or 10 billion star system. Where are you guys coming in on this?
Well, this conversation started because Netflix just announced they're changing their their rating system algorithm, where they're going to get rid of their little five-star thing and they're going to just change to a basic thumbs up, thumbs down, mm-hmm. which is going to allow them to make better recommendations. Mm-hmm. But it also means that the chances of people discovering new movies, new things, mm-hmm. is going to go way down.
Yeah.
So the chances that you're going to watch something outside of your normal wheelhouse is going to be decreased substantially.
Yeah.
So for Movie Freak, I have to rate on a four-star scale.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just do, because it's part of the world of online reviewing. That's what people want. When I write for the Seattle Gay News, I am not beholden to a star scale. I do not like having a star scale. I don't like having any sort of rating scale, because I want people to read what I have to say about a film. Not every movie fits into, this is 3 stars, this mm-hmm. is 4 stars, this is 2.5 stars. And not every 3-star film is the same. I mean, mm-hmm. I've had people look at me and go, well, you know, you've given Personal Shopper and you've given Logan both 3.5 stars. Does that mean they're similar? And I'm like, hell no.
Right.
But all people end up looking at is that star rating. They'll like look at your headline, they'll maybe read a couple lines, and they'll look at your star rating, and that's it. And I don't think they're getting a good feel of as to what a movie really is.
Yeah, and that's very similar to what Brian the Movie Guy was facing when he was first starting mm-hmm. movie reviews, and program director Kent Phillips over at Star 101.5 said to him, okay, Brian, we really gotta tone this down, because people don't really care if it's a C- or a C+ or a B- or give me an A or an F. Simplify, which, to his point, was, I get it, we kind of needed that simplification because that gradation gets to be difficult. But at the same point, for those of us who are splitting hairs, it actually really does matter. So,
Well, what do you think, Steve?
Steve?
Well, I come from old school criticism, by which I mean the classic European and American tradition.
Sure.
And the critics whom I grew up reading and hearing are the ones I still admire the most. They're the ones who don't give you a thumbs up or thumbs down. They're the ones who provide you with so much context mm-hmm. and so much fact about a film, in addition to, you know, offering sort of an overview of what it's all about and its relative quality, that you're allowed to appreciate how sophisticated, how complex an experience going to a movie can be.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's just straight up, straight down, A or an F, you don't really know what to make of it. And it's right. really going to hurt the more sophisticated, challenging kinds of films, no matter what the genre may be. I mean, Get Out would be hurt by
yes.
that kind of A or F kind of mm-hmm. kind of rating. And one thought just about Rotten Tomatoes, because I make it constantly.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you see a fresh or a rotten rating there,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't tell you everything. You need to read the review.
Yeah,
because isn't that so true?
Someone has to make an editorial judgment. Is this relatively more positive or negative? If it's a great filmmaker and I'm a little disappointed, but it's still better than 90% of what you're going to see this year, how do you rate that? Where do you place that on the spectrum?
Well, and I'm looking at Rotten Tomatoes right now.
I was going to say, how many times have we seen these either singing reviews, yet it still gets a rotten, or somewhere in between where it's moderately okay, but it's still getting completely panned. Is that?
Yeah. I mean, you look at something like Life. Life right now is sitting at 65% on Rotten Tomatoes. But then you go in and look at the actual reviews, and they're all of the 2.5-star, C+,
mm-hmm.
really middle-of-the-road variety. So somebody looks at that and goes, oh my God, it's at 65% on Rotten Tomatoes. That means it must be awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't necessarily mean it's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, like the Lego Batman movie is at 91%. And I mean, I get it. Everybody really liked that movie. It was a fun film. But almost all of those reviews were, again, kind of like B-. They weren't over the moon, best of the year sort of stuff. And yet, if you're just basing this on Rotten Tomatoes, you're going to think the Lego Batman movie is probably going to end up being one of the highest rated films of the year, when in reality, it isn't.
Yeah. So I guess the bottom line is we need to look for deeper context, or more than just the thumbs up, the thumbs down. We need to continue our discourse. We need to continue to dig deeper into the various different films that we're witnessing or wanting to witness and to learn more about. That being said, talking about what we have just discussed, where did we leave off here? Life getting a theater and a rental split from the Squabblers. Also looking towards Wilson getting a theater recommendation. The Devil's Candy getting a theater or find this on VOD as best you can recommendation,
yes.
right?
Just watch it.
Right. Dig this one up if you can. A Personal Shopper getting 2 theaters and a rental. And Trainspotting 2, or T2 as it were, 3 strong theater recommendations from the Squabblers. Sarah, you working on any other projects at this point?
I've got two interviews up right now, one with Danny Boyle for T2 and one with Olivier Assayas for Personal Shopper, both at moviefreak.com.
Yes.
And then I will also be hosting a Q&A on Sunday at the Seattle Jewish Film Festival and their 8 o'clock show. I will be there hosting the Q&A for that.
And that's at Pacific Place.
That is correct.
Okay. Steve, do you have anything that you've got in the hopper at this point? You've always got something.
Well, actually, I've got another educational project in the hopper. I also teach at Edmonds Community College on a regular basis, and I'm working actually on a multi-part course, probably for next fall or winter quarter, on film music, combining the very best of contemporary symphonic composers with the tradition of classical composers who set the stage for them, the Prokofievs, Shostakovichs, Vaughan Williams, Waltons, and others who wrote great symphonic / classical film music, bearing out the point that we make all the time that an increasing number of people are coming to orchestral and symphonic music in our time through film.
Wow.
And let's find the connection.
Can I just come sit in on that?
Two questions. Yeah.
For a price.
Sarah wants to come sit on that. I would love to know more about this. Do you know what the course is going to be called? Can we find this in the Edmonds community? I want to call it class?
Yes, yeah. Eventually, once I make a decision.
Okay. So we'll be having to watch Edmonds Community College, I believe, .edu or something along those lines.
ECC.edu, yeah.
ECC.edu. We'll have to check this one out further and keep our eyes and ears peeled. So this has been Cinema Squabble, episode number 53. Steve Reeder, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
Thanks for the invitation. I loved it.
Yeah, and Sarah, as always, good to see you. And we'll catch you guys next time. And thanks much to Sprint's Arbogast, our producer.